Paul Davies, thanks very much for joining us today. We want to talk about useless research, and you might be just the person to help us out. We do appreciate it.
Having spent a lifetime doing useless research, I feel I'm a bit of an expert.
Well, Paul, I remember as a new senator and relatively young at the time, always going to medical research dinners because they were always interesting and you could learn something. But one in particular sticks in my mind, and that was the one prior to which you gave a lecture entitled In Praise of Useless Research. And I still feel somewhat excited when I remember that speech because it was so good. Now, many people, when they want to get stuck into funding, say, well, let's get rid of all that useless stuff. Where's that going? Can you give us, let's start this conversation off with a really good example of something that scientists were doing and politicians and the public said, what a useless load of rubbish, and it's turned out to be really valuable.
Well, there's an obvious one, which is the means by which our listeners are hearing us now, that is radio waves. And the story here is in the 19th century, physicists realised that there was a connection between electricity and magnetism, but they hadn't quite worked it out properly. And in the 1850s, a famous theoretical physicist, James Clerk Maxwell, sat down with all the equations that people had put together and tried to amalgamate them and realised that there was something missing, and he put in a sort of fudge factor. He didn't like the look of them, so he added a term just because he thought that it looked better that way. And lo and behold, immediately followed that there exist radio waves. What actually happened was he worked out the speed. He found that these equations had wave-like solutions, looked at the speed of the waves, saw that it was the speed of light, figured that light was an electromagnetic wave and that there should be longer waves, which we now call radio waves. And within about 10 years, they were being produced and detected. And so there we have something which was purely an academic exercise. It was mathematical physicists not liking the look of the mathematics and, in effect, spawning an entire new industry. So that's a very good example. He didn't set out with a view to inventing a new communication tool. He set out with a view to try to understand how the world works and whether there is a beauty in nature, as indeed there is.
Look, that's a good example, but for that fundamental research, a physicist saying it just didn't look right means that we can now talk on radio, we can use radio in all the fantastic ways that it does. But what about some others?
Well, there was another example in the 20th century. This was Paul Dirac, another British theoretical physicist. And again, he didn't like the look of the equations. He was just sort of messing with the mathematics. In this case, it was the mathematics describing electrons, those fundamental particles that are part of atoms. And he was led to conjecture that there should exist what we might call anti-electrons. The name we use is actually positrons. So it was in the early 1930s that these should be like electrons, but with the opposite electric charge. And a couple of years later, they were found. And you might say, well, who cares about that? The positron, for example, is the first particle of what is generically called antimatter. And so we read all about antimatter and see it in the movies, and it's a great science fiction theme. You might say, well, does antimatter have any uses? Well, not nearly so many uses as radio waves, but it certainly does have some uses. And there's a procedure in medical diagnosis called PET, positron emission tomography, and the positrons are the particles I just mentioned. Nobody knew they existed in the 1920s. Dirac predicted them from looking at the equation. So it's another example coming from theoretical physics. So I've given you two examples from theoretical physics, but I suppose the general point I want to make is that a lot of things which find value in everyday life through technology for making our lives easier, a lot of these things are really byproducts of what are fundamental research projects. So they're spin-off, as to use the term. And the thing is that you often don't know in advance what that spin-off will be. And governments have a pretty bad track record of trying to direct research towards specific goals. Now, there are times when that can work, and the classic examples are the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb and the Apollo Project to put a person on the moon. Both of these had very clearly defined scientific principles behind them. In other words, the science was understood and it was really an engineering challenge. That's where government-directed research can work well, where it's very clear what the objective is, what the scientific principles are. It's just a matter of mobilising the resources and solving some technical problems.
Application.
Right. But you see, if you think, well, wouldn't it be great to discover something cool about the brain or blood or, you know, plants or something, and just sort of set out to dabble around, well, it's no good. Or if you even think of something like flight, you think about the early days of trying to realize this dream. Humans have always wanted to fly. And so the early people, as it were, the goal-oriented people, built wings and flapped the wings, and they thought, well, birds fly, we should try and imitate birds. Totally the wrong approach. It was actually the internal combustion engine that solved the problem. So if you set about going in a direct way, going about solving a problem, chances are you will waste an awful lot of money.
So is the guiding parameters that we should, insofar as we can afford, and we should be looking to make ourselves afford as much as we can, fund those people who are simply really good in their field to go wherever they think they can go, to take us to knowledge of science that we don't now have, to find new things, and then later find what we can actually do with them?
Right. I regard the practical application as a bonus, that the primary purpose of doing fundamental research is to work out how the world works. You couldn't want a better example than astronomy. You wouldn't embark on doing astronomy in order to solve some sort of problem, like a cure for cancer. You embark on astronomy because you're fascinated by the fact that we live in this wonderful universe and you want to know what's out there. And that's what motivates astronomers. Now, obviously, you should be limited in the amount of money you spend. No society is going to spend 10% of its GDP just on figuring out how the world works. But can we not spend some small fraction? In total, science budgets tend to be about 1% of GDP, and of that, only a tiny fraction is spent on truly fundamental research. But you see, the way nature works, it's Mother Nature cares nothing for our economic imperatives. It's not like the world is put together in such a way that the things that we need for our economies are going to be just those areas where Mother Nature will reveal her secrets, if I could put it like that. In other words, where the scientific frontier will yield, the chances of that being just where we want it to yield, it will yield wherever we happen to have the right brain power, the right creative thinking, and the right expertise. And it may be something that is completely irrelevant to what we want in terms of practical applications, or it may give applications in some other area entirely. We should just push at that frontier wherever we can, in a spirit of trying to figure out how the world works and what our place in it might be.
Let me take you back to the lecture that I found so fascinating. You raised the example of laser beams, and I think you were using one of these things at the time, those lecture pointer things, and used it as an example of something that when it was first done, people thought, well, what are you doing that for? Why are you just sending little, you know, red lights across a room? What use is that? And of course, laser technology is now just about everywhere. I doubt you could get through a day without, you might not realise it, but I doubt you could get through a day without coming across it in one way or another.
In the 60s, lasers were described as an invention in search of a market or a use. And it's dear to my heart because the man who invented the laser, Charles Townes, is now in his mid-90s. I know him well, and I saw him only a couple of weeks ago, and he's still going to work, even in his mid-90s. He still has a lab, and he still can talk with great authority about basic physics. It's a wonderful story. And it's true that lasers have now penetrated so many aspects of the commercial world and the scientific world, and we do take them for granted, but it took a long time for their applications to be discovered. And once again, when he invented the laser, he really wasn't thinking, well, we need some better way of speeding up checkout queues or something like that. And that's simply the way that science works, that scientists are interested. They find a curious phenomenon, they want to pursue it. And later on, they may think about applications. And time again, even in mathematics, there was a famous mathematician in Cambridge by the name of Hardy. And he was fond of saying that proud of saying that his mathematics would never have any application. It was a branch of mathematics called number theory, theory of numbers. Very easy to imagine. So he did mathematics in the morning, watched the cricket in the afternoon, and thought no one would ever find any use for his stuff. But lo and behold, in this modern day of cryptography, all of this early number theory turns out to be really, really important. So you just never know, even in a rarefied area like number theory and mathematics, you just never know what applications may be further down the track. But there may be none. And let me take a contemporary example, the Higgs boson, because this has been very much in the news in the last few months.
Yes.
Because of its apparent discovery. And I will remind you, there's a machine in Switzerland called the Large Hadron Collider. It's 27 kilometers in circumference. It's a vacuum tube around which protons are accelerated in counter-rotating beams. They smash into each other at enormous energies and make all sorts of stuff. And among the stuff that comes out are these elusive particles predicted by a theoretical physicist by the name of Peter Higgs in 1963 and have been sought after in accelerator machines and collider machines like this for decades, now apparently found. And why did Europe spend €8 billion looking for this elusive particle predicted by theory? And the answer is because there is a missing piece of the jigsaw that enables our understanding of subatomic matter and the forces that act in subatomic matter to hang together as a coherent picture. And this is that piece of the jigsaw. And so the motivation was to see, is our understanding of the basic structure of matter correct? I haven't heard anybody say that they have dreamt up an application for the Higgs boson. I can't immediately think of any use of the Higgs boson. But I think the point here is that in trying to build a theory of the micro world, the world within the atom, at the smallest scale of size, we are trying to complete a program that was begun in ancient Greece 2.5 millennia ago by the early Greek atomists, the idea that the world is made up of a few fundamental building blocks and that we can come to know, if we could access a small enough scale of size and a high enough scale of energy, we can come to know how the world is put together in terms of these fundamental building blocks. We're not there yet with the Higgs boson, but it's a huge step forward. And I think it's just good that we know how the world is built from the bottom up, just like we are beginning to find out how it's built on a large scale in cosmology.
Sure.
And in between is the realm of the very complex, the realm of human beings, of life, of consciousness, of human affairs. That's much tougher.
Mm. In the lecture that you gave in praise of useless research, you highlighted that Australia had been in the top, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 countries to launch satellites, but stopped, and apparently stopped, because politicians said, well, that's just a bunch of scientists sending up boxes, you know, into the air that go beep beep. And it's probably an opportunity, well, not probably, clearly an opportunity lost to Australia, because the public and the politicians didn't understand that you cannot always see the benefit of knowledge, but you've got to keep at it, keep extending the field of knowledge, because one day, well, I think we can be sure that it will be valuable, and I might be not be alive, you might not be alive, but I'm sure that Higgs boson will find some application. It will be found for it.
Well,
I'm sure
of that. It may. I'm not going to say it won't. I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that the motivation for looking for it was not, well, who knows what we may be able to use it for. It is really to test our fundamental understanding of the nature of matter and forces. And it's interesting you raise the space program. It's very much in the forefront of my thoughts, because just last week we had a visit from Andy Thomas, Australia's famous astronaut. He came and spent a couple of days with us here in Arizona. And we had a symposium about how to reinvigorate the manned, or crewed as it's supposed to be, space program. We're stuck in low Earth orbit, can we go beyond that, and so on. And so this whole issue about space and the commercialization of space and who's in space and why are we there is very much in the forefront of my thoughts. And that back in the early days, Woomera was a spaceport. It was a center for launching at least high-altitude rockets, and it could have become a much more important player. It's not got the best geographical location for really heavy lifts, but it could still play a role. And I have long felt that an opportunity was missed there. And the point about satellite technology, let's keep it closer to home. The manned space program is one thing. I'd love to see humans going to Mars, but just satellites for weather forecasting or GPS or anything like this, we depend more and more on them. And either a country chooses to buy into that is that they do their own, or they have to rent somebody else's space on somebody else's, and that's what Australia is having to do. And so that's another example in which you do need a lot of foresight. Looking back historically, Australia decided to back away from pursuing the space research program and really never got back in the game. Not regarded as a serious player, even though much smaller countries are.
Well, Paul Davies, thank you very much for giving up your time. It is always a pleasure, and I hope that we have a wide listening audience to this program, so that any doubters about the value of pure or useless research can be brought on board and support governments of all persuasions to put a bit more money that way and find their savings somewhere else. It's been a pleasure.
I hope so,
thank
too. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you.
And Paul Davies is Director of BEYOND, the Centre for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. On RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.